Chapter 10, A Beauty to Rescue. Beauty is not only a terrible thing, it is also a mysterious thing. There God and the devil strive for mastery, and the battleground is the heart of men. Fyodor Dostoevsky. You'll be glad every night that you treated her right. George Thorogood, from Treat Her Right, by Roy Head and Gene Kurtz. Cowboy, take me away, closer to heaven and closer to you. The Dixie Chicks, from Cowboy, Take Me Away. Once upon a time, as the story goes, there was a beautiful maiden, an absolute enchantress. She might be the daughter of a king or a common servant girl, but we know she is a princess at heart. She is young, with a youth that seems eternal. Her flowing hair, her deep eyes, her luscious lips, her sculpted figure. She makes the rose blush for shame. The sun is pale compared to her light. Her heart is golden, her love as true as an arrow. But this lovely maiden is unattainable, the prisoner of an evil power who holds her captive in a dark tower. Only a champion may win her. Only the most valiant, daring, and brave warrior has a chance of setting her free. Against all hope he comes. With cunning and raw courage, he lays siege to the tower and the sinister one who holds her. Much blood is shed on both sides. 3 times the knight is thrown back, but 3 times he rises again. Eventually, the sorcerer is defeated. The dragon falls. The giant is slain. The maiden is his. Through his valor, he has won her heart. On horseback, they ride off to his cottage by a stream in the woods for a rendezvous that gives passion and romance new meaning. Why is this story so deep in our psyche? Every little girl knows the fable without ever being told. She dreams one day her prince will come. Little boys rehearse their part with wooden swords and cardboard shields. And one day, the boy, now a young man, realizes that he wants to be the one to win the beauty. Fairy tales, literature, music, and movies all borrow from this mythic theme. Sleeping Beauty, Cinderella, Helen of Troy, Romeo and Juliet, Antony and Cleopatra, Arthur and Guinevere, Tristan and Isolde. From ancient fables to the latest blockbuster, the theme of a strong man coming to rescue a beautiful woman is universal to human nature. It is written in our hearts, one of the core desires of every man and every woman. I met Stacy in high school, but it wasn't until late in college that our romance began. Up till that point, we were simply friends. When one of us came home for the weekend, we'd give the other a call just to hang out, see a movie, go to a party. Then, one summer night, something shifted. I dropped by to see Stacy. She came sauntering down the hall barefoot, wearing a pair of blue jeans and a white blouse with lace around the collar and top buttons undone. The sun had lightened her hair and darkened her skin, and how is it I never realized she was the beautiful maiden before? We kissed that night, and though I'd kissed few girls in my time, I'd never tasted a kiss like that. Needless to say, I was history. Our friendship turned to love without my really knowing how or why, only that I wanted to be with this woman for the rest of my life. As far as Stacy was concerned, I was her knight. Why is it that 10 years later, I wondered if I even wanted to be married to her anymore? Divorce was looking like a pretty decent option for both of us. So many couples wake one day to find they no longer love each other. Why do most of us get lost somewhere between once upon a time and happily ever after? Most passionate romances seem to end with evenings in front of the TV. Why does the dream seem so unattainable, fading from view even as we discover it for ourselves? Our culture has grown cynical about the fable. Don Henley says, "We've been poisoned by these fairy tales." There are dozens of books out to refute the myth, books like Beyond Cinderella and The Death of Cinderella. No, we have not been poisoned by fairy tales, and they are not merely myths. Far from it. The truth is, we have not taken them seriously enough. As Roland Hines says, myths are stories which confront us with something transcendent and eternal. In the case of our fair maiden, we have overlooked 2 very crucial aspects to that myth. On the one hand, none of us ever really believed the sorcerer was real. We thought we could have the maiden without a fight. Honestly, most of us guys thought our biggest battle was asking her out. And second, we have not understood the tower and its relation to her wound. the damsel is in distress. If masculinity has come under assault, femininity has been brutalized. Eve is the crown of creation, remember? She embodies the exquisite beauty and the exotic mystery of God in a way that nothing else in all creation even comes close to. And so, she is the special target of the evil one. He turns his most vicious malice against her. If he can destroy her or keep her captive, he can ruin the story. Every woman can tell you about her wound. Some came with violence, others came with neglect. Just as every little boy is asking one question, every little girl is as well. But her question isn't so much about her strength. No, the deep cry of a little girl's heart is, "Am I lovely?" Every woman needs to know that she is exquisite and exotic and chosen. This is core to her identity, the way she bears the image of God. Will you pursue me? Do you delight in me? Will you fight for me? And like every little boy, she has taken a wound as well. The wound strikes right at the core of her heart of beauty and leaves a devastating message with it. No, you're not beautiful, and no one will really fight for you. Like your wound, hers almost always comes at the hand of her father. A little girl looks to her father to know if she is lovely. The power he has to cripple or to bless is just as significant to her as it is to his son. If he's a violent man, he may defile her verbally or sexually. The stories I've heard from women who have been abused would tear your heart out. Janet was molested by her father when she was 3. Around the age of 7, he showed her brothers how to do it. The assault continued until she moved away to college. What is a violated woman to think about her beauty? Am I lovely? The message is, no, you are dirty. Anything attractive about you is dark and evil. The assault continues as she grows up, through violent men and passive men. She may be stalked, she may be ignored. Either way, her heart is violated and the message is driven farther in. You are not desired. You will not be protected. No one will fight for you. The tower is built brick by brick, and when she's a grown woman, it can be a fortress. If her father is passive, a little girl will suffer a silent abandonment. Stacy remembers playing hide-and-seek in her house as a girl of 5 or 6. She'd find a perfect place to crawl into, full of excited anticipation of the coming pursuit. Snuggled up in a closet, she would wait for someone to find her. No one ever did, not even after she was missing for an hour. That picture became the defining image of her life. No one noticed. No one pursued. The youngest in her family, Stacy just seemed to get lost in the shuffle. Her dad traveled a lot, and when he was home, he spent most of his time in front of the TV. An older brother and sister were in trouble in their teens. Stacy got the message. Just don't be a problem. We've already got too much to handle. So she hid some more. Hid her desires, hid her dreams, hid her heart. Sometimes she would pretend to be sick just to get a drop or two of attention. Like so many unloved young women, Stacy turned to boys to try to hear what she never heard from her father. Her high school boyfriend betrayed her on a prom night, told her he had been using her, that he really loved someone else. The man she dated in college became verbally abusive. But when a woman never hears she's worth fighting for, she comes to believe that's the sort of treatment she deserves. It's a form of attention in a twisted way. Maybe it's better than nothing. Then we fell in love on that magical summer night. But Stacy married a frightened, driven man who had an affair with his work because he couldn't risk engaging a woman he sensed he wasn't enough for. I wasn't mean. I wasn't evil. I was nice. And let me tell you, a hesitant man is the last thing in the world a woman needs. She needs a lover and a warrior, not a really nice guy. Her worst fear was realized. I will never really be loved. Never really be fought for. And so she hid some more. Years into our marriage, I found myself blindsided by it all. Where's the beauty I once saw? What happened to the woman I fell in love with? I didn't really expect an answer to my question. It was more a shout of rage than a desperate plea. But Jesus answered me anyway. She's still in there, but she's captive. Are you willing to go in after her? I realized that I had, like so many men, married for safety. I married a woman I thought would never challenge me as a man. Stacy adored me. What more did I need to do? I wanted to look like the knight, but I didn't want to bleed like one. I was deeply mistaken about the whole arrangement. I didn't know about the tower or the dragon or what my strength was for. The number one problem between men and their women is that we men, when asked to truly fight for her, hesitate. We are still seeking to save ourselves. We have forgotten the deep pleasure of spilling our life for another. There are three things that are too amazing for me, four that I do not understand. The way of an eagle in the sky, the way of a snake on a rock, the way of a ship on the high seas, and the way of a man with a maiden. Proverbs 30:18-19. Agur, son of Jacob, is onto something here. There is something mythic in the way a man is with a woman. Our sexuality offers a parable of amazing depth when it comes to being masculine and feminine. The man comes to offer his strength, and the woman invites the man into herself, an act that requires courage and vulnerability and selflessness for both of them. Notice first that if the man will not rise to the occasion, nothing will happen. He must move. His strength must swell before he can enter her. But neither will the love consummate unless the woman opens herself in stunning vulnerability. When both are living as they were meant to live, the man enters his woman and offers her his strength. He spills himself there, in her, for her. She draws him in, embraces and envelops him. When all is over, he is spent. But ah, what a sweet death it is. And that is how life is created. The beauty of a woman arouses a man to play the man. The strength of a man, offered tenderly to his woman, allows her to be beautiful. It brings life to her and to many. This is far, far more than sex and orgasm. It is a reality that extends to every aspect of our lives. When a man withholds himself from his woman, he leaves her without the life only he can bring. This is never more true than how a man offers, or does not offer, his words. Life and death are in the power of the tongue, says Proverbs. She is made for and craves words from him. I just went upstairs to get a glass of water from the kitchen. Stacy was in there baking Christmas cookies. The place was a mess. To be honest, so was she, covered with flour and wearing a pair of old slippers. But there was something in her eye, something soft and tender, and I said to her, "You look pretty." The tension in her shoulders gave way. Something twinkled in her spirit. She sighed and smiled. "Thank you," she said, almost shyly. If the man refuses to offer himself, then his wife will remain empty and barren. A violent man destroys with his words. A silent man starves his wife. "She's wilting," a friend confessed to me about his new bride. "If she's wilting, then you're withholding something," I said. Actually, it was several things. His words, his touch, but mostly his delight. There are so many other ways this plays out in life. A man who leaves his wife with the children and the bills to go and find another, easier life has denied them his strength. He has sacrificed them when he should have sacrificed his strength for them. What makes Maximus or William Wallace so heroic is simply this. They are willing to die to set others free. This sort of heroism is what we see in the life of Joseph, the husband of Mary and the stepfather to Jesus Christ. I don't think we fully appreciated what he did for them. Mary, an engaged young woman, almost a girl, turns up pregnant with a pretty wild story. "I'm carrying God's child." The situation is scandalous. What is Joseph to think? What is he to feel? Hurt, confused, betrayed, no doubt. But he's a good man. He will not have her stoned. He will simply divorce her quietly. An angel comes to him in a dream, which shows you what it sometimes takes to get a good man to do the right thing, to convince him that Mary is telling the truth and he is to follow through with the marriage. This is going to cost him. Do you know what he's going to endure if he marries a woman the whole community thinks is an adulteress? He will be shunned by his business associates and most of his clients. He will certainly lose his standing in society and perhaps even his place in the synagogue. To see the pain he's in for, notice the insult that the crowds will later use against Jesus. "Isn't this Joseph and Mary's son?" they say with a sneer and a nudge and a wink. In other words, "We know who you are, the bastard child of that slut and her foolish carpenter." Joseph will pay big time for this move. Does he withhold? No. He offers Mary his strength. He steps right between her and all of that mess and takes it on the chin. He spends himself for her. They will be called oaks of righteousness. Isaiah 61:3. there, under the shadow of a man's strength, a woman finds rest. The masculine journey takes a man away from the woman so he might return to her. He goes to find his strength. He returns to offer it. He tears down the walls of the tower that has held her, with his words and with his actions. He speaks to her heart's deepest question in a thousand ways. Yes, you are lovely. Yes, there is one who will fight for you. But because most men have not yet fought the battle, most women are still in the tower. Most men want the maiden without any sort of cost to themselves. They want all the joys of the beauty without any of the woes of the battle. This is the sinister nature of pornography, enjoying the woman at her expense. Pornography is what happens when a man insists on being energized by a woman. He uses her to get a feeling that he is a man. It is a false strength, as I've said, because it depends on an outside source rather than emanating from deep within his center. And it is the paragon of selfishness. He offers nothing and takes everything. We are warned about this sort of man in the story of Judah and Tamar, a story that, if it weren't in the Bible, you would have thought I drew it straight from a television miniseries. Judah is the fourth son born to Jacob. You might remember him as the one who came up with the idea to sell his brother Joseph into slavery. Judah has three sons himself. When the eldest becomes a man, Judah finds a wife for him named Tamar. For reasons not fully explained to us, their marriage is short-lived. But Er, Judah's firstborn, is wicked in the Lord's sight, so the Lord put him to death. Judah gives his second son to Tamar, as was the law and custom of that time. It is Onan's responsibility to raise up children in his brother's name, but he refuses to do it. He is a proud and self-centered man who angers the Lord, so we put him to death also. You're beginning to get the idea here. Selfish men, a woman wronged, and the Lord is mad. Judah has one son left, Shelah. The boy is the last of his strength, and Judah has no intention of spending it on Tamar's behalf. He lies to Tamar, telling her to go back home, and when Shelah is old enough, he'll give him to her as her husband. He does not. What follows is hard to believe, especially when you consider that Tamar is a righteous woman. She disguises herself as a prostitute and sits by the road Judah is known to use. He has sex with her, uses her, but is unable to pay. Tamar takes his seal and cord and staff as a pledge. Later, word gets out that Tamar is pregnant. Judah is filled with what he insists is righteous indignation. He demands that she be burned to death, at which point Tamar produces the witness against him. See if you recognize whose seal and cord and staff these are. Judah is nailed. He more than recognizes them. He realizes what he's been doing all along. She is more righteous than I, since I wouldn't give her to my son Shelah. A sobering story of what happens when men selfishly refuse to spend their strength on behalf of the woman. But the same thing happens in all sorts of other ways. Pretty women endure this abuse all the time. They are pursued, but not really. They are wanted, but only superficially. They learn to offer their bodies, but never, ever their souls. Most men, you see, marry for safety. They choose a woman who will make them feel like a man, but never really challenge them to be one. A young man whom I admire is wrestling between the woman he is dating and the one he knew but could not capture years ago. Rachel, the woman he is currently dating, is asking a lot of him. Truth be told, he feels in way over his head. Julie, the woman he did not pursue, seems more idyllic. In his imagination, she would be the perfect mate. Life with Rachel is tumultuous. Life with Julie seems calm and tranquil. You want the Bahamas, I said. Rachel is the North Atlantic. Which one requires a true man? In a brilliant twist of plot, God turns our schemes for safety on us, requiring us to play the man. Why don't men offer what they have to their women? Because we know down in our guts that it won't be enough. There is an emptiness to Eve after the fall, and no matter how much you pour into her, she will never be filled. This is where so many men falter. Either they refuse to give what they can, or they keep pouring and pouring into her, and all the while feel like a failure because she is still needing more. There are three things that are never satisfied, warns Agur, son of Jacob. Four things that never say enough. The grave, the barren womb, land, which is never satisfied with water, and fire, which never says enough. The barrenness of Eve you can never hope to fill. She needs God more than she needs you, just as you need Him more than you need her. So what do? Offer what you have. I'm afraid it won't work, a client said to me when I suggested he move back toward his wife. She's given up on me coming through for her, he confessed, and that's good. No, it's not, I said. That's awful. He was headed to a family reunion back east, and I suggested he bring his wife with him, make it a vacation for the two of them. You need to move toward her. What if it doesn't work, he asked. So many men are asking the same question. Work for what? Validate you as a man? Resurrect her heart in a day? Do you see now that you can't bring your question to Eve? No matter how good a man you are, can never be enough. If she's the report card on your strength, then ultimately you'll get an F. But that's not why you love her, to get a good grade. You love her because that's what you were made to do. That's what a real man does. My friend Jan says that a woman who is living out her true design will be valiant, vulnerable, and scandalous. That's a far cry from the church ladies we hold up as models of Christian femininity, those busy and tired and rigid women who have reduced their hearts to a few mild desires and pretend everything is going just great. Compare their femininity with that of the women named in the genealogy of Jesus. In a list that is nearly all men, Matthew mentions four women, Tamar, Rahab, Ruth, and Uriah's wife. That Bathsheba goes unnamed tells you of God's disappointment with her, and of his delight in these three whom he takes a notable exception to name in an otherwise all-male cast, Tamar, Rahab, and Ruth. Whoa, this will open up new horizons of biblical femininity for you. Tamar, we now know. Rahab is in the Hall of Fame of Faith in Hebrews 11 for committing treason. That's right, she hid the spies who were coming in to scope out Jericho before battle. I've never heard a women's group study Tamar or Rahab, but what about Ruth? She's often held up as a model at women's studies and retreats, but not in the way God holds her up. The book of Ruth is devoted to one question. How does a good woman help her man to play the man? The answer? She seduces him. She uses all she has as a woman to arouse him to be a man. Ruth, as you'll remember, is the daughter-in-law of a Jewish woman named Naomi. Both women have lost their husbands and are in a pretty bad way. They have no man looking out for them, their financial status is below the poverty line, and they are vulnerable in many other ways as well. Things begin to look up when Ruth catches the eye of a wealthy single man named Boaz. Boaz is a good man, this we know. He offers her some protection and some food, but Boaz is not giving Ruth what she really needs, a ring. So what does Ruth do? She seduces him. Here's the scene. The men have been working dawn till dusk to bring in the barley harvest. They've just finished and now it's party time. Ruth takes a bubble bath and puts on a knockout dress. Then she waits for the right moment. That moment happens to be late in the evening when Boaz has a little too much to drink. When Boaz had finished eating and drinking and was in good spirits. Good spirits is in there for the more conservative readers. The man is drunk, which is evident from what he does next. Pass out. He went over to lie down at the far end of the grain pile. What happens next is simply scandalous. The verse continues, Ruth approached quietly, uncovered his feet, and lay down. There is no possible reading of this passage that is safe or nice. This is seduction, pure and simple, and God holds it up for all women to follow when he not only gives Ruth her own book in the Bible, but also names her in the genealogy. Yes, there are folks that'll try to tell you that it's perfectly common for a beautiful single woman in that culture to approach a single man who's had too much to drink in the middle of the night with no one else around the far side of the grain pile and tuck herself under the covers. They're the same folks who'll tell you that the Song of Solomon is nothing more than a theological metaphor referring to Christ and his bride. Ask them what they do with passages like, Your stature is like that of the palm and your breasts like clusters of fruit. I said, I will climb the palm tree. I will take hold of its fruit. Song of Solomon 7:7-8. That's a Bible study, right? No, I do not think Ruth and Boaz had sex that night. I do not think anything inappropriate happened at all. But this is no fellowship potluck either. I'm telling you that the church has really crippled women when it tells them that their beauty is vain and they are at their feminine best when they are serving others. A woman is at her best when she is being a woman. Boaz needs a little help getting going, and Ruth has some options. She can badger him. All you do is work, work, work. Why don't you stand up and be a man? She can whine about it. Boaz, please hurry up and marry me. She can emasculate him. I thought you were a real man. I guess I was wrong. Or she can use all she is as a woman to get him to use all he's got as a man. She can arouse, inspire, energize, seduce him. Ask your man what he'd prefer. Will you fight for her? That's the question Jesus asked me many years ago, right before our 10th anniversary, right at the time I was wondering what had happened to the woman I married. You're on the fence, John, he said. Get in or get out. I knew what he was saying. Stop being a nice guy and act like a warrior. Play the man. I brought flowers, took her to dinner, and began to move back toward her in my heart. But I knew there was more. That night, before we went to bed, I prayed for Stacy in a way I'd never prayed for her before. Out loud, before all the heavenly hosts, I stepped between her and the forces of darkness that had been coming against her. Honestly, I didn't really know what I was doing, only that I needed to take on the dragon. All hell broke loose. Everything we've learned about spiritual warfare began that night. And you know what happened? Stacy got free. The tower of her depression gave way as I began to truly fight for her. And it's not just once, but again and again over time. That's where the myth really stumps us. Some men are willing to go in once, twice, even three times. But a warrior is in this for good. Oswald Chambers asks, God spilt the life of his son that the world might be saved. Are we prepared to spill out our lives? Daniel is in the midst of a very hard, very unpromising battle for his wife. It's been years now without much progress and without much hope. Sitting in a restaurant the other night, tears in his eyes, this is what he said to me. I'm not going anywhere. This is my place in the battle. This is the hill that I will die on. He has reached a point that we all must come to, sooner or later, when it's no longer about winning or losing. His wife may respond, and she may not. That's really no longer the issue. The question is simply this. What kind of man do you want to be? Maximus? Wallace? Or Judah? A young pilot in the RAF wrote just before he went down in 1940, "The universe is so vast and so ageless that the life of one man can only be justified by the measure of his sacrifice." As I write this chapter, Stacy and I have just returned from a friend's wedding. It was the best nuptials either of us have ever been to, a wonderful, romantic, holy affair. The groom was young and strong and valiant. The bride was seductively beautiful, which is what made it so excruciating for me. Oh, to start over again, to do it all over the right way, marry as a young man, knowing what I know now. I could have loved Stacy so much better. She could have loved me so much better as well. We've learned every lesson the hard way over 18 years. Any wisdom contained in these pages was paid for, dearly. On top of that, Stacy and I were in a difficult place over the weekend. That was the campfire. Satan saw his opportunity and turned it into a bonfire without even one word between us. By the time we got to the reception, I didn't want to dance with her. I didn't even want to be in the same room. All the hurt and disappointment of the years, hers and mine, seemed to be the only thing that was ever true about our marriage. It wasn't until later that I heard Stacy's side of the script, but here is how the two fit together. Stacy, he's disappointed in me. No wonder why. Look at all these beautiful women. I feel fat and ugly. Me, I'm so tired of battling for our marriage. How I wish we could start over. It wouldn't be that hard, you know. There are other options. Look at all these beautiful women. On and on it came, like a wave overwhelming the shore. Sitting at the table with a group of our friends, I felt I was going to suffocate. I had to get out of there, get some fresh air. Truth be told, when I left the reception, I had no intention of going back. Either I'd wind up in a bar somewhere or back in our room watching TV. Thankfully, I found a small library off to the side of the reception hall. Alone in that sanctuary, I wrestled with all I was feeling for what seemed like an hour. It was probably 20 minutes. I grabbed a book but could not read. I tried to pray but did not want to. Finally, some words began to arise from my heart. Jesus, come and rescue me. I know what's going on. I know this is assault. But right now it all feels so true. Jesus, deliver me. Get me out from under this waterfall. Speak to me. Rescue my heart before I do something stupid. Deliver me, Lord. Slowly, almost imperceptibly, the wave began to lift. My thoughts and emotions quieted down to a more normal size. Clarity was returning. The campfire was just a campfire again. Jesus, you know the pain and disappointment in my heart. What would you have me do? The bar was no longer an option, but I was still planning to just go straight to my room for the rest of the night. I want you to go back there and ask your wife to dance. I knew he was right. I knew that somewhere down, deep inside, that's what my true heart would want to do. But the desire still seemed so far away. I lingered for 5 more minutes, hoping he had another option for me. He remained silent, but the assault was over, and the bonfire was only embers. Once more, I knew the man I wanted to be. I went back to the reception and asked Stacy to dance. For the next 2 hours, we had one of the best evenings we've had in a long time. We nearly lost to the evil one. Instead, it will go down as a memory we'll share with our friends for a long, long time. Stacy has given me a number of wonderful presents over the years, but last Christmas was unforgettable. We'd finished with the feeding frenzy the boys call unwrapping presents. Stacy slipped out of the room with the words, "Close your eyes. I have a surprise for you." After a good deal of rustling and whispers, she told me I could look. Before me was a long rectangular box on the family room floor. "Open it," she said. I removed the bow and lifted the lid. Inside was a full-size claymore, a Scottish broadsword exactly like the one used by William Wallace. I had been looking for one for several months, but Stacy did not know that. It was not on my Christmas list. She had done this out of the vision of her own heart, as a way of thanking me for fighting for her. Here is what her note read. "Because you are a brave heart, fighting for the hearts of so many people, and especially for mine. Thanks to you, I know a freedom I never thought was possible. Merry Christmas."